Good morning. We'll call the meeting of the Property and Local Tax Division to order. I don't know if we have a quorum, but we're close.
We do.
Okay. But we have a lot of in-depth stuff that we want to take up this morning. A lot of we'll do that. Backgrounding. And we're getting into more of the specifics and the kind of the arcane, the uniquenesses of our property tax system. So, you know, let's just say that there's no question that shouldn't be asked, no question too dumb. I think everybody learns something every time they go through this information. So it should be fascinating. And frankly, you know, as we look ahead, maybe out of necessity, we're going to need to look, you know, more closely at how the LGA formula and some of these other property tax aids are structured so that we have a chance, you know, to make sure dollars are used in the best places possible. So, at any rate, is there a motion? Do I have a motion here for approving the property or the minutes of the January 19th meeting?
Madam Chair, I so move.
Was that?
Right here, Madam Chair.
Representative Detmer moves the minutes of the Property and Local Tax Division from January 19th. All approved? Say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay. Minutes are approved. And I think we're starting today with Pat Dalton, if I'm not mistaken. So we will just move ahead. I think, though, keep in mind that if there is interest, and we're going to just issue an invitation that anyone interested in being part of an LGA working group, we want to form that, and it's bipartisan, so anyone who is interested, please let Bobby Patrick know, and we'll start doing some meetings. So, anyway, welcome, Pat, and we're eager to hear your good stuff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Pat Dalton with House Research, and Steve Hines and I are going to take you through a history of the two main aid programs in a little bit more detail and explain the formulas in a little bit more detail. So this would be a good time to ask questions about them. Just to put things in context, there are really three types of property tax relief programs. There's the aid programs, of which local government aid or LGA and county program aid are the two that currently exist. However, there have been other aid programs that have existed in the past, Homestead and Agricultural Credit Aid, commonly referred to by its acronym of HACA, which was essentially eliminated in 2001, Disparity Reduction Aid, and then some of the county program aids that were folded into the county, the old county aids that were folded into the county program aid. There are the credit programs. That's what the market value homestead and agricultural credit are current credit programs. And then there's direct payments to taxpayers, which are the property tax refund, the renter's credit, and targeting. And Ms. Schill, later on, hopefully today, will be talking in more detail about how all of those fit together. But we're going to start with an overview of the local government aid program, the LGA program, and then the county program aid. There's a lot of misinformation about the history of the local government aid program, so we're going to give you the really brief overview of the last almost 40 years of this program. The program did start in 1971. It was part of the Minnesota Miracle. First payments occurred in 1972. It was really a program to replace a number of smaller tax sharing programs that currently existed at that time with one large significant state program. And the goals of the program at that time were to provide property tax relief. That was its number one goal. That was one of the number one goals of the Minnesota Miracle. And then to also ensure sufficient revenue for local government needs. One of the trade-offs that occurred with the establishment of the LGA program, which a lot of people don't realize, is that's when the legislature enacted the prohibition against new local sales or income taxes. And it was actually written as one of the subdivisions of the local government aid program. So it was a very clear trade-off at that point. Originally, LGA went to all local governments except school districts. It was not a city-only program. That's something that's kind of evolved over time. Originally, it was distributed to counties based to the county level based on population, and then it was distributed within the counties based on fiscal need. And fiscal need, how you measure fiscal need has been one of the ongoing debates in the local government aid program. Originally, it was just measured by your previous property tax levy. So if you had high property taxes, you were considered needier and got more of the distribution. Originally, it included guarantees that every local government would receive at least what it had under the old shared tax system. Those guarantees are kind of led to something else, which existed for most of the history of LGA, and that was what is called grandfathered aid, but we'll talk about that in a minute. As I said, originally local government aid was went to everybody, went to special districts, towns, counties, and cities. In 1972, you can see very little of it goes to special districts. That's the very top little tiny black line. But even back in 72, it was primarily an aid program for cities. And then over time, the share paid to other jurisdictions was eliminated. Special taxing districts were eliminated in 1979. Payments to counties were eliminated in 1991. But very shortly thereafter, they started getting general purpose aids under other specific county programs. County criminal justice aid began in 1993. Family preservation aid began in 1995. And then those programs and the old HACA, Homestead and Agricultural Credit Aid, were rolled in to the existing county program aid in 2004. So although they were eliminated from LGA, they have generally gotten aid under other programs. And then payments to towns were eliminated in 2002. Although payments to towns for most of the 90s was very, very little. It was on the order of a dollar per capita.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A number of us are new to the committee, and there are a whole series of acronyms here. Could you describe them before as we go through? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, let me see. The acronyms I've used. CCJA, County Criminal Justice Aid, was a program that essentially gave money to counties based on some crime statistics. However, it was not specifically dedicated. It didn't have to be used for public safety, but the factors kind of related to crime and public safety were used in determining that aid. Family Preservation Aid looked at things like poverty levels and similar population, age of population, poverty levels, and things like that in determining its aid. Again, it was felt that it was related to some of the social service needs in a county, but again, there was not a specific dedication that the money had to be used for it. It just used factors related to those programs. HACA stands for Homestead and Agricultural Credit Aid. We used to have market value credits. I may actually defer to Steve to talk about kind of that history.
If you just hold a moment, Mr. Hines. Representative McDonald, did you have a question?
I did. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, he could certainly finish answering the question before mine.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Hines.
Madam Chair, Steve Hines from House Research. HACA, the Homestead and Agricultural Credit Aid Program, came into being in 1989, and it kind of replaced the two programs, the Homestead Credit and the Agricultural Credit, that existed in the 70s and 80s. And those were credit programs which were determined after taxes, and they were turned into an aid program, which is determined before levies are spread and sort of notified in advance. So it was a big program in terms of dollars and a significant part of this of the landscape from about 1990 through to, for the 90s, basically, when that was replaced. we can get into it more if people want to know about the distribution, but that was a major factor around here until 2001's reform.
Representative McDonald?
Madam Chair, thank you. Pat, Ms. Dalton, I'm sorry. Just a question on page 2 regarding slide 3 and 4. I'm going to refer to slide 4 first, the last statement, which the state included a guarantee that each local government unit would receive at least what it had under the old system. I'm presuming that the old system refers to the trade-off that prohibited cities for local new sales tax or income taxes. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative, no, it refers to the tax-sharing programs that were replaced. We used to share a portion of cigarette tax and a couple of the other smaller taxes directly on a per capita basis to local governments. And so when this replaced those, we guaranteed everyone would at least get what they used to under the old tax-sharing formulas. Prior to 1971, there was actually only one local sales tax, and that was the city of Duluth. And if we get to a discussion of the local sales taxes, which I think we will at some point because they are going to be referred down to this committee, I understand, we'll do the whole history of local sales taxes. But the only one that existed at that time was Duluth, and all the other ones have been enacted since this prohibition through special law.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I guess just to follow up quickly, did it work? Did the LGA replace what the old system that the cities had? Did it replace the income lost, or even more so?
Madam Chair, Representative, it replaced the income lost, plus there was an increase to virtually every place. And if I think the next slide actually shows, or next couple of slides actually shows kind of the growth in that program over time. And I think that's a really good kind of segue into that. The program started out at about $64 million in nominal dollars. And as you can see, it has grown significantly over time. And then if you notice, we occasionally go through these peaks followed by sudden reductions, and then we start growing again, peaks and sudden reductions. What was going on in the late 1980s, early 1990s, was that there was some restructuring of aids to local governments. One of the big things that was going on is the legislature made a determination to shift some of the money that they used to give to cities and give it to schools instead. So, you know, you see that peak and then a sudden drop. That's related to some shifts of aids from the cities over to the schools. In 2002, you see a big peak in that, and that's because, as Mr. Hines had mentioned, there had been this HACA program, Homestead and Agricultural Credit Aid. Part of that money had been going to cities, and when that program was eliminated, part of that, the HACA that used to go to cities, was rolled into the local government aid program as an increase into the appropriation for that program. Not all of it, but a portion of it. As you notice, this is not, although there's a lot of, in the last decade, there have been several instances where we have, the amount of aid certified has not actually been paid. This is not the first time that has happened. You can see that actually happened in right around 1992 as well. And there is a very interesting little, if you look at 1992, there's actually one year where the amount of aid paid exceeded the amount of aid certified. The state actually paid more money to the cities than we had promised them. And the reason was, it was related to the half cent non-optional local sales tax. At that point, we had basically dedicated revenue to pay a variety of 8 programs. We said that if the counties had enacted this half-cent sales tax, we would take the revenues from that and the revenues from 1.5 cents of the state sales tax, all of that money would go to the local governments. And in 1992, there was more money in that program at the end of the year than anyone had anticipated, and so everyone actually got a windfall payment in December of 1992. It's the only time that's ever happened. And after that, the local government trust fund, which was that dedicated revenue program, was repealed, and now these aids are paid out of the general fund again.
Oh, Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regarding the spike that happened in 2000 to 2002, probably, went up quite a bit in those 2 years. How much of that had to do with the fact that we had a surplus during that period of time, and we had, I guess, cash coming out in droves, and so we needed we gave a third back to the taxpayer and spent two-thirds of the surplus during that period of time. Did this have anything to do with that occurrence?
Ms. Dalton? Madam Chair, Representative, I would say it actually had more to do with the fact that that was also the era when we were doing a really major reform in education, and we were taking over a lot of the education funding at the state level, and the distribution of where that money was going versus where local government aid goes is different. And this was actually a throwing more money into LGA in some ways was a balancing decision to essentially provide roughly equal property tax relief in both outstate Minnesota and greater Minnesota, because a lot of the school takeover had a very major impact on property tax relief in the suburbs and not as big a impact in outstate Minnesota. And so a lot of local government aid had an impact on outstate Minnesota, and so that's where why this program had an increase at that time.
Representative Barrett, to follow up?
Okay.
Representative Benson, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You may have just partly answered this already, but why were payments to towns eliminated, or what was the rationale behind doing that in 2002?
I'm sorry, I'm
Ms. Dalton?
Missed the question. Someone else was talking.
I'm just asking what was the rationale for eliminating payments to towns in 2002?
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative, as I said, at that time, the payments to the towns were incredibly small. It was about $1 per capita, and it really wasn't having a major impact on their budget. There's 1,850-some towns in the state of Minnesota. It's a lot of checks to cut for not very much money. I think it was more an administrative decision.
Ms. Dalton, what is the official definition of a town, then, just for our edification?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it has to do with how they're organized for governing purposes. Cities have city councils. City councils set their budget. In a township, the voters essentially get to vote on the budget. Ms. So it's a government. We have very large townships. We have White Bear Township, which is larger than most of the cities in the state, but their voters get to vote on their budgets.
Just wanted to clarify. I mean, township, towns, interchangeable term.
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. Let's see. Is there a follow-up? No. Okay. Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this just puts LGA funding, this is another way of looking at LGA funding over time, using constant dollars as opposed, so this is inflation-adjusted dollars. You had a very steep increase if you're looking at just nominal dollars, but if you're looking at inflation-adjusted dollars, there has been some increase since the 70s, but clearly. And one of the things I wanted to point out is between 1992 and 2000, that number is relatively flat. And there's a reason for that. Yeah, in that period, there was an automatic inflator in the LGA appropriation program. And that inflator was whatever inflation was with a minimum and a maximum, no less than 2.5% growth, no more than 5% growth. And from a person who has to draft legislation in LGA, that was kind of the golden age of LGA. People pretty much left that program alone during that period, partially because there was that automatic inflator.
Ms. Dalton.
Unlike county program aid, which Mr. Hines can talk about in a little bit more detail, LGA has been a relatively significant part of city budgets. And this is just for all cities. And LGA is the black bar. And as you can see, you know, it's varied between 10 and 15% of overall city budgets. Within individual cities, that number has gone at, I've seen a few cities where that number is as high as 60%. And clearly there are some cities that get no local government aid. Now we get to the fun stuff. How do we actually distribute the money?
Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dalton, during the periods of time, these years that are shown on page 5, slide 9, do you have any sense of what was going on in terms of the average size of city budgets or revenues?
Madam Chair, Representative, I can't tell you that right off the top of my head. I do know that actual city budgets between, and I only know this because I did this comparison, I was updating a biennial report that we do, that city budgets actually declined a little bit between 2006 and 2008 overall in total. What they've done over the entire period, I don't know. However, I could get that information for you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wardlow?
Could you? That would be very helpful just to see what city budgets have done since 1973 through 2008. I would expect there to be a decline from 2006 to 2008 given the Great Recession, if you will, of 2008. But it would be interesting to see that data to give this chart some context.
I'd be happy to do that.
And Ms. Dalton, this chart we're looking at then, is this reflecting all cities, whether they receive LGA or not, or is this just the group of cities that do?
Madam Chair, this is all cities.
All cities.
And this is one thing I should point out. This is general revenue. This is their general fund budgets. One of the things that we have been noticing lately is that there is a significant growing portion of city budgets that are going outside of the general fund. They're becoming part of their public service enterprises. Essentially, some city services that used to be traditionally provided as part of their general budget are now being fee-based, things like street lighting and some other street sweeping and things like that, which more and more cities have been moving those into public service enterprises, and those are recorded separately in the state auditor's reports. So this isn't a complete picture of all city budgets. This is their general fund budgets.
Representative Crawford. Representative Loeffler.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Dalton, as you know, this has been an area of concern to me in terms of those enterprise activities that you said have been moved off the chart. And if there's a way using the auditor's data or some other way to get us some information on it, that would be helpful. And the reason I've been concerned about this area is when you get into street lighting fees and street maintenance fees and all those kind of fees, it really defeats the property tax credit program that we have that helps low-income people. A lot of times it's seniors on fixed incomes with their property tax bill because those fees don't qualify for our refund program, where if it was in the general property tax levy, it would. It also is not deductible against their federal income taxes. And so because we have restrained our state support for cities, they've gotten creative But it's in ways that's really made some other tools that we've used to help taxpayers less effective.
All right, Ms. Dalton?
Now to get into the real nitty-gritty, and yes, this will be like watching paint dry, as people describe it. LGA formulas. during the 1970s mm-hmm. and 1980s, literally the LGA formula got tinkered with virtually every legislative session. Little tweaks were made to it. I basically described the initial formula, which was in place for 72 to 75. Then we moved to looking at equalized mill rates. The money was still distributed to counties on a per capita basis, but then we were looking at mill rates rather than levies in setting shares. In 1980 through 1989, we really kind of moved to the formula, the basic formula or concept that we have now, which is aid should be based on fiscal need minus fiscal capacity. During that period, need was measured as 3 years of average levy, and fiscal capacity was equalized assessed property values. Capacity has pretty much never changed since then. That tends to be what we have used generally, is an equalized tax base. But people have not been terribly happy with how you measure need, and so that's the part of the formula that's been changed on a pretty regular basis. The one other thing I want to talk about, during the period between 1972 and 2002, or actually 1993, is what we call what I refer to as the rolling grandfather. And basically what that was is it basically said that if there was more money in the system, a city could not get less than it had gotten in the previous year. So once you've got money, you've got to keep it. Even if your population was declining, even if you no longer needed it, even if your wealth was going up, if you got that money once, you got to keep it forever. By the middle 1980s, this was causing a lot of consternation, and that's when people started talking about you could get a better distribution if you threw the money out of an airplane, out of the back of an airplane flying over Minnesota.
Excuse me a second. Representative Wardlow.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dalton, when you say rolling grandfather and you say that a city, once it got a certain amount of money, could not get less going forward, of course, no legislature can buy in a future legislature, correct? So you're saying that was just the way it happened. Each legislature saw fit not to change that provision.
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct. That was the provision that was in the statute. And as you will see in 1993, there was a major reform to the LGA formula. And this was the first time that the rolling grandfather was eliminated. We didn't eliminate the grandfather. Basically, there was a new formula in 1993. As I said, everyone was pretty unhappy with where things were in the late 1980s, and there were a number of studies that were done in the late 1980s and early 1990s looking at how should this be reformed, and it really focused on how do we measure city need. There was a study that was commissioned by the legislature called the LAD study that hired a number of university professors who came in and took a look at, you know, spent a year taking a look at data on cities and doing a regression analysis on how do you measure need for various parts of city budgets and developed a need formula. There was the Governor's Core Commission under Ernie Carlson that actually looked at developing a measure of minimal requirements and try to develop different measures of needs. And the League of Minnesota Cities, seeing the handwriting on the wall, actually in 1991, did their own study on how do you measure city need and developed some need measures. And the legislature adopted those need measures. So the 1990, the formula that began really in 1993, the need measures had actually been developed through a regression analysis that was done by the League of Minnesota Cities. The formula basically used the factors developed by the league minus ability to pay the equalized tax base. That formula distributed money that was an increase over 1993 money. So everyone was essentially grandfathered at their 1993 level. But any increases in the LGA appropriation from there on would be developed, would be distributed via the formula. And you could lose money from that formula amount. So in 1993, there was $9 million distributed via the formula and about $320 million distributed via the grandfather. By 2002, there was about $240 million distributed via the formula and $320 million distributed by grandfather. And of that $240 million, you know, a city could gain or lose on a year-by-year basis depending on how their factors had changed relative to the factors in other cities. So that was a big change for 1993. 2002 is... and then again, as I had mentioned, from 1993 to 1994, there was an automatic inflator in the appropriation. So the appropriation grew every year, somewhere between 2.5% and 5%, depending on what inflation was. And then in 2003, a new formula was enacted. There are a couple of arguments for doing a new formula. To begin with, the need factors that had been determined in that had been enacted in 1993 were based on data that existed in 1990, and city circumstances had changed. So if nothing else, those need formulas really did need to be reviewed and updated, and you could probably make the same argument today that as the new census data becomes available, the legislature should probably be looking at the need factors developed in 2003 and update them for, again, change city circumstances.
Ms. Dalton, have any cities been added to the program since the original group of cities? Have any left the program? Or has it remained a static group of cities?
Madam Chair, Representative, cities have joined and left based on whether they become cities or not. We've had cities who have consolidated, and so we seem to vary between about 800 and in my 20 years here, we vary between 800 and I think lowest was 52 and 856 cities. Townships can choose to become cities, to incorporate into cities. Cities can choose to consolidate. Cities can choose to dissolve. So we have had some changes in the cities. All cities are, in theory, eligible for this program. Nobody is prohibited from being part of this program. However, the formula in this program may say that, and certainly does say, that certain cities don't need aid and don't, therefore they don't get money under the program. So everyone's eligible, but not everybody gets money because the formula essentially zeroes them out.
We need to locate, turn off. Ms. Dalton?
The big factors, the new 2003 formula, and this formula was literally developed by the governor and the Department of Revenue. And presented to the legislature, which adopted pretty much the governor's recommendation. New need measures were developed for large cities in particular. Large cities for purposes of LGA formulas are cities with a population over 2,500. There are 182 cities that fall into that category out of 854. So the vast majority of cities in this state are under 2,500 population. There are different need measures for large cities and small cities, and I will talk about what those are in a minute. One of the really big changes in 2003 is virtually all of the grandfathered aid was eliminated. There are several provisions in statute that provide specific amounts to individual cities based on unique circumstances. And those cities literally came into the legislature over the course of 20 years and made their case why they were unique, why they needed some extra money. Those have been written into law, and those have been retained. And that accounts for $30 million of grandfathered aid that's still out there. The biggest portion of that is what's called regional center aid, which I will talk about in a little bit. And that's about $24 million of it, and that essentially goes to cities in outstate Minnesota with a population of 10,000 or more as of the 2000 census. And it's a frozen amount that goes to those cities. In 2003, taconite aids were added into the measure of fiscal capacity for cities. For those who are not familiar with the Iron Range, cities get taconite aid as a payment because they do not impose property taxes on the mine. And so this really is part of their, you know, base property tax capacity. And so that became an offset to their need in the formula. There were caps put on annual increases or decreases to individual cities to mitigate volatility. We had particularly a number of small cities who virtually were going to lose all their aid because almost all of their aid came from their grandfathered aid, and we phased them out actually over a 20-year period. So they're, you know, the goal was to move everyone to the formula, but not to necessarily, you know, just whack them off at the knees.
Excuse me. We have a question, I think. Representative McDonald?
Just a question regarding the taconite aid. In the just to restate that, so they don't pay property tax to the communities. Do they pay the property tax, commercial property tax?
Mr. Hines.
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, the production, the taconite industry pays a production tax in lieu of property taxes on the both the mines and on the production facilities themselves. And that is the production tax is based on the amount of production per ton and is paid into, I believe it's actually paid to the St. Louis County assessor collectively. But anyway, there's a formula in law that determines where that money goes, and a substantial portion of that is distributed back to the cities, counties, school districts on the Iron Range in according to a formula that has to do with kind of where the mining activity is, what level of mining activity is, and various different types of functions. For instance, school bonds get a certain percentage, and school operating get a certain percentage, et cetera. So it's a very, like a lot of things around here, complicated set of formulas that determine how that money gets distributed. But ultimately, it is kind of an in lieu of property tax that does go back to the jurisdictions on the range.
Representative McDonald?
Madam Chair, then at what year did the legislature decide that in because of those extra taxes going to the community and the local governments that they needed an additional aid called taconite aid from the rest of the state? Just curious. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, the taconite aid Ms. Dalton's referring to is coming from that, is the amount that comes from the taconite production money. It's not state general purpose aid. It's not from the state.
Madam Chair, thank you. That's I hope that was helpful for all. Certainly. Thank you.
Ms. Dalton?
Finally, the other thing I wanted to point out is the automatic growth in the LGA appropriation was eliminated in 2003. And I believe at that time it was frozen at a dollar amount of about $434 million. thereabouts. I'm close. And I know about $48 million was added a couple of years later to make it $484 million. Unlike the 1993 formula, which pretty much was left alone from 1993 to 2002. Nobody really left alone. The formula enacted in 2003. People have not been happy with it. There's been the big debate has been whether it has adequately measured need and is it too volatile. One of the disadvantages of taking out the grandfather aid is that this makes aid to individual cities can fluctuate fairly significantly on a year-to-year basis. And so there have been a lot of attempt to add caps on annual, you know, limiting annual increases and decreases, or trying to, one of the factors that has changed since 2004 to 2010 is need is now based on 2 years worth of data, the last 2 years worth of data. This kind of smooths out some of the changes, and that's actually why that was enacted. The other thing that happened was that we started using data that's available January of the year that the aid is certified, which is the year before it's paid. The reason we do that is so when we're doing modeling, believe it or not, when we're doing modeling here in the legislature, we will be able to model pay 2012 fairly accurately starting in February, because we will have virtually all the data we need to do that modeling. And so what we're telling you cities will get at that time will actually match what cities will be certified. Previously to that, we were using, to this change, we were using estimated data because not all the data was available until July. And because you now have $500 million distributed via this formula, small changes in some of that data could have led to some significant changes in what was actually going to cities. So some of our projections during the legislative session did not match reality, and this made people very uncomfortable. So that change was made. As I said, people were not happy that need was adequately measured. Two different need formulas have been added, small city aid and jobs-based aid, which we'll talk about. And over 3 years, TAC night payments were removed from the measure of fiscal capacity. So they were in there for about 3 years, and then they were removed for some of the cities, and then eventually they were removed for all of the cities. So we're back to just using tax base as a measure of fiscal capacity. And as I said, there were appropriation increases enacted in 2008 that were going to affect pay 2009, 10, and 11. But all of those were really the appropriation increases that occurred prior to the cuts that we talked about last week. Okay. How do we measure need? As I said, today, we have two different formulas, one for large cities, one for small cities. I'm going to start with the small cities first because they're the easiest to explain. These are the four factors that are listed under small cities are the same four factors that were used in the 1993 formula. One of the reasons is when the governor and the legislature decided to change the formula in 2003, they basically gave themselves about 3 months to do the analysis to come up with how you measure need. And the previous measures had taken about a year to develop. So instead of actually going through and looking at all possible factors that might influence small city formula need, they just basically said, we're going to take the factors that have been used in the past, and we're just going to do a new statistical analysis to weigh those factors differently. But we aren't going to try to actually explain variations in spending looking at a whole bunch of new factors. For the large cities, they actually, the governor and the Department of Revenue did actually meet with a lot of different cities, talk to them about what they thought were the factors that influenced city need. I believe that they looked at something like 40 different variables looked at statistical analysis of these different variables and came up with new need measures. So the measures that are in both formulas are percent of housing built before 1940. This is a proxy for essentially the age of the city. The more housing you have built before 1940, probably the more established and developed your city is. Percent population decline over the last 10 years. All the aid formulas work on a per capita basis, but the reality is most cities have infrastructure built for their peak population. So if you have population decline, your costs on a per capita basis tend to be going up because you're still supporting infrastructure that had been built at your peaks, at your highest population level. Percent of property value classified as commercial industrial for small cities. You know, if you've got a lot of retail or commercial or industrial development, you tend to have higher costs. You also tend to have people coming into your city that you provide services to, as opposed to just strictly being a bedroom community. Transform population. Transform population is almost the cubed root of the population times a number that's almost equal to 30.
This oh my gosh.
That precise
more
math.
More information needed.
Yeah. This number was actually developed by the League of Minnesota Cities back in 1993 to fit a spending line better to the small cities. I'm not even going to try to justify it. It just exists. remaining large city factors. Average number of road accidents per capita for the most recent three-year period. This is the one that is the least intuitive to members, and it is the one that's caused the greatest consternation. And if you've been around and heard Representative Covina talk about it, he loves to make a lot of fun of this. A number of cities came in and talked, when they talked to the Department of Revenue staff, they talked about different factors that led to overburden in their cities. Communities that had colleges and universities talked about the fact that they had a lot of students who came in and they had to serve those students, but they didn't count as part of their population, and so their costs were higher. City of Minneapolis came in and said, we have this enormous parks and museum, arts and cultural facilities. We bring a lot of people into the city. They do not get counted, but they put a lot of burden on our community. St. Paul came in and said, we have all the government buildings. They don't pay taxes, but they bring a lot of people in. We provide services to the people who come in to access those government facilities. Those are some of the examples. Because they tend to have those things all, they're all arguing the same thing, that they have overburden caused by people coming in who are not residents of their population that are not measured by commercial industrial activity. But on the other hand, that each of those factors affect so few cities that they didn't end up being statistically relevant when they did the analysis. And then somebody came up with the bright idea of saying, you know what? All those people are driving into all those cities. And you would think that they would have more congestion in their roads because they have more people. So if you look at the road accident rate per capita, you know, this might correlate. And in fact, it ended up correlating with all of those overburden factors. And that's how it ended up in the formula. So now you actually understand why accident rates are used. Average household size, the formula, as I said, is based on a per capita basis. But the argument is that really you don't serve people, you serve households. And so this kind of makes that adjustment. And then there is a factor that basically says that it costs a little bit more on a per capita basis to deliver services in outstate Minnesota than it does in the metropolitan area. And partially that's due to the fact that there's more opportunities for consolidation and cooperation of providing services just because you're physically located next to other cities that you can cooperate and consolidate with.
Excuse me one second. Representative Lencheski,
thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, just listening to Ms. Dalton go through the need formulas, and it is amazing they haven't been changed really for a while, you know, when you look at the history. And Madam Chair, to you, I would encourage you to take a look at changing the formula. I do think with the new census data, that's the time. You know, I will just say for the rest of the committee, you know, I am one who supported and believed that the formula change that we're discussing now that happened under Governor Pawlenty and Chair Abrams was a good one. It was very controversial, a lot of bloodletting between rural, suburban, and urban. And as someone who represents a community who doesn't receive these aids and, you know, never will under any formula, I think the interest of those legislators is, you know, if we're going to have programs, boy, we better get them to people in need, not to grandfather mechanisms that just say, because you used to get it, you always should, whether you need it or not. So I think the big formula changes that took place did, you know, really tried to, in my estimation, and this is very controversial, made the system fairer. I think at the time when that was all taking place, a lot of the angst and frustration that was happening for legislators was that simultaneously things were getting cut. So legislators were confusing the formula versus the funding. And so I think this committee needs to be always thinking about funding levels are one thing, but formulas are formulas, whether you have a lot of money or a little money, the formula needs to work. And so I think, you know, these calculations on how do you measure capacity and ability to pay, and then how do you measure need are really critical for this committee. And, you know, I do have a question for Ms. Dalton and maybe just for the committee to understand how this works. You know, there are a whole bunch of things that are measured as need and fiscal capacity or for the ability to pay side and not. So, for example, we now have all kinds of cities that have local option sales taxes. You know, it's no surprise to anybody who's served on the tax committee. I'm a big opponent of those. But we don't count them in the formula. So if you have these other things going on, you know, you are wealthier than the formula would say, and you don't have to count it as part of what's coming into your revenue stream. And so in my estimation, you're getting more aid than you need to because you're having these other revenue streams that no one's counting. And there are a number of them. You know, do you have local liquor stores? Do you have, you know, all kinds of things. I think the measure of pre-1940 housing is a terrible one. I've always opposed that. It sort of says that for everybody in the state who doesn't have cities before 1940, which there are many of us, no matter what happens, you'll never receive any aid, ever. Even if in 200 years, you know, you still won't have one house. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot to kind of go through with all these things. And I think as someone who, again, does not receive those aids and does not think that cities like mine should, that just grows the need for government to have more spending into more programs. It's just, you know, let's really make sure it's getting where it's needed. But, you know, my question for Ms. Dalton would be one thing that hasn't come up in the overview last time, I don't think, or this time, and I think would be helpful for committee members to think about, is the role of fiscal disparities in the LGA system, the largest system for property tax relief, the biggest fund of all, is fiscal disparities. Fiscal disparities is a bigger dollar amount per year than county program aid or LGA. And why doesn't the state legislature spend a lot of time thinking about it? Because it doesn't take state dollars. It's city-to-city transfers. So fiscal disparities is in the seven-county metro, and it's a revenue-based sharing system between cities. So, you know, of course, I have an interest because there's about 30 cities, I think, that give to the rest of not just the metro, but the entire state. And so, I think for understanding all these things, I think we should talk about fiscal disparities just for a second, because often outstate legislators think, well, that's in the metro, that doesn't affect me. And that's absolutely not true. The fact that fiscal disparities is sending money to each other's cities, it's first buying need so that LGA can go further. So every single legislator is benefiting from the existence of this program. And if we could just have a little bit of understanding how the fiscal disparities and LGA combine to assist Greater Minnesota.
All right, excellent points, Representative Lencheski. Maybe we can get a response here.
Madam Chair, Representative Lencheski, I believe what she's talking about is the fact that She's right. Fiscal disparities essentially is a way of sharing tax base among communities in the Seven County metropolitan area. That shared tax base is taken into account in the fiscal capacity measure of LGA. So if you are a beneficiary of fiscal disparities, your fiscal capacity is actually higher in the LGA measure. If your fiscal capacity is higher, you get less LGA. LGA is distributed, we have a set dollar amount, and we distribute all of that dollar amount. We pay a percentage of unmet need, the difference between cities' need minus their fiscal capacity. So if right now we're paying, one of my slides actually says it, but I think we're paying about 75% of unmet need. If we didn't use the tax base after the fiscal disparities transfer had occurred, there would be some cities in the metropolitan area that would be needier and would suck up more of the LGA. Because they are seen as less needy after fiscal disparities, they don't take as much LGA, and that means there's more LGA to distribute to the rest of the cities. And I believe that's what Representative Lincheski is referring to.
Representative Lincheski, any follow-up?
Just thank you.
All right, thank you.
And to point out, the cities that tend to be net contributors to the fiscal disparities pool are also, their tax base tends to be so high that they tend not to get LGA at all. So losing a little of their tax base has no impact on the LGA because they don't get it. As I said, there is extra need recognized outside of the basic need formulas. We talked about regional center aid. It goes to outside cities with a population in 2,000 of greater than $10,000. This is the only general need that is not offset by fiscal capacity. You get this whether you've got a really high fiscal capacity or you have a low fiscal capacity, and this goes to outside cities in that category, and it's based on their population. Over 5,000 is a flat dollar per capita amount times your population over 5,000, and there's a cap of $2.5 million on it. Small city aid is aid that goes to cities with a population less than 5,000. Its amount is $8.50 times the city population. That $8.50 goes up and down as the appropriation increases and decreases. So its share of the appropriation stays roughly the same. City job space aid is the newest need measure in the LGA formula. It goes to cities greater than or equal to 5,000 population. So in other words, all cities who don't qualify for small city aid qualify for city job space aid. It's calculated at $25 times your jobs per capita times your population, with a maximum payment of $4.7 million to any city under this. If you qualify for this and you are also getting regional center aid, this amount is adjusted down slightly for about 36. It's adjusted down about 36%. So there's a little bit of an interaction between the jobs base aid and the regional center aid.
Representative Crawford, a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can a city get both of those aids, regional city aid and the city jobs based aid? Is that what you just said?
Representative Crawford, yes, they can. City jobs based aid, there is no geographic limitation. You can go to cities in the metro and in the non-metro. It goes to all cities over 5,000. The regional center aid only goes to cities in outstate Minnesota. There is, as I said, about a 36% reduction in city jobs-based aid if you are getting regional center aid. But the small city aid and the city jobs-based aid can be reduced if your fiscal capacity exceeds your general formula need. But regional center aid is a grandfathered aid program.
Ms. Dalton, is it safe to say that we continue to make this more complicated and more incomprehensible, even to those people who get it? I mean, this is kind of amazing to hear where we're going still.
Madam Chair, I would frankly say the current formula is the most complicated formula with the most bells and whistles in my 25 years of doing this. I'm almost done. Fiscal capacity and unmet need. As I said, fiscal capacity is your adjusted tax base. It's your adjusted net tax capacity multiplied by the average city tax rate from the previous year. So basically we're trying to say you should be able to cover all your needs as measured by this formula if you were imposing an average tax rate. We don't care whether you are or not. We're assuming you are. And, if you can meet all of your need, you will get no money under the formula. If you can't, then we will pay you a portion. Then the formula pays them a portion of their unmet need. And that portion is based on whatever portion we can pay and stay within the appropriation cap, which for pay 2011 was $527 million. We could pay 79.5% of unmet need. If your unmet need is negative, you have more capacity than you have need, then we adjust your small city aid and job space aid down, which is why we still have some cities who qualify for city job space aid, like the city of Bloomington, who still gets no LGA because their fiscal capacity is more than enough to meet both their unmet need and the need measured in their job based aid. So your final aid is your formula aid, the unmet need, the small city aid, and job based aid, which cannot be less than zero, plus your grandfathered aid, which, as I said, there's $30 million of it statewide, about $24 million of it is regional center aid, and the other $6 million is money going to individual cities. And then, as I said, there are caps on how much you can increase or decrease on an annual basis. And this is to kind of keep shocks out of the individual payment system. They can't go up too much, too quickly, or go down too quickly. No individual city's aid can increase by more over last year's amount by more than 10% of their previous year's levy. And then there are several alternate caps on the decrease, and the decrease depends on city size. The maximum decrease to any city is, I believe, $300,000 in any one year. And there are caps based on 2003 aid amounts for small cities. You can't go down more than 5% of your 2003 aid. And as I said, that had to do with the fact that we had a number of small cities who, when we did the formula change and they eliminated the grandfather, that essentially eliminated all their aid, so we're phasing them in over 20 years. And so I think I'm going to end right there.
Well, Ms. Dalton, I just have a question. So you've got this broad view you take on the system. I mean, the goal for every city is to have an increasing tax base, I presume, because you spin off more taxes and so on. So is there any correlation at all between the growth of city tax bases and the presence of LGA? Do we know?
Madam Chair, increased city tax bases increase your fiscal capacity. As your fiscal capacity is going up, absent any other changes to the system, the amount of LGA you will get will be going down. The one thing that is important to recognize is that all of this is relative to how well you are doing compared to other cities, because we're paying a percentage of unmet need. If lots of cities are doing a lot better than you, they're growing faster than you, they're falling off the system, that means you will get more aid because they will need less aid. Your needs are growing faster than other cities and your tax base is not increasing, the opposite will occur. On the other hand, if you're pretty much staying the same, but other cities are changing, that will impact how much money you get on a year-to-year basis, because it's all a relative amount. It's always based on how you are doing relative to all the other cities in the state.
Great. So, Representative McDonald?
Yeah, hopefully, thank you, Madam Chairman, fellow committee members, Ms. Dalton. Hopefully, it's a quick question and a quick answer. The original intent of the LGA in 1972 was to help assist local governments with public safety, such as fire and police. Is that correct or false?
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative, there were no limits on what the money could be spent for. And although I was not around for the debates in 1972, I was still in high school. At least my reading does not indicate that any of the debate at that time was to say it was supposed to be specifically used for certain factors. It was to help make sure all cities could meet their general service needs, but I'm not sure that it was ever, even the rhetoric was tied to specific needs, specific, you know, for public safety. And statutorily, there has never been that type of thing.
Representative McDonald, any follow-up?
Well, just in follow-up, just in referring to former state legislators who was here at the time and being a former mayor, and I'm sure those who are on this council who were former mayor and councilmen have heard the urban legend, if you will, that it was for infrastructure, especially public safety, fire and protection. So that, true or false, that's what I've been told and some other by former legislators and as a mayor. So if that was the intent, how come then fire and police budgets were never calculated or even hadn't been considered calculated into the formula? I mean, as you said, it's the most complicated formula that you've ever witnessed. And why is not there budgets of fire protection and maybe even infrastructure, even aging infrastructure included in the formula? It seems like that would be a reasonable solution to some of the formula. That's
Madam Chair, Representative, just because it has not been written in statutorily doesn't mean it hasn't been proposed or discussed over the years. I have worked with members in the past who have wanted to tie it specifically to public safety expenditures, and the formula, when the LAD study was actually looking at developing need measures, they actually divided city city budgets into different areas: roads, public safety, general administration, and developed different need measures for each of the different spending groups. So, and when the core commission was developing need measures, they also did the same thing. So it's certainly been something that people have been interested in and have certainly talked about. There have been proposals to do that in the past, and there certainly can be proposals to do that in the future. I know one of the big discussions has been, what is the purpose of LGA? And my answer to that is, the purpose of LGA is whatever you all decide is the purpose of LGA. LGA may have had a specific purpose in 1971, and that purpose may have changed over time, and you certainly have the choice to change the purpose in the future. But to develop a formula, you need to first be able to articulate what it is that you want to, you know, what the goal of the program is, and then from there you can start, you know, figuring out, based on that goal, what should be the need factors, what should be the ability to pay factors.
Michelle, did you have some additional?
I do, Madam Chair and members. This might be jumping ahead. We've not reviewed this spreadsheet or any other of the aids that we actually support through appropriations from this committee. We have a whole section on local pension aids, most of which go to police and fire. And it's my understanding the very first one was created in the early 70s, and we have kept separate aid to police and fire since that time and have had a steady appropriation for that. So perhaps, and I was not here at that time either, but it's my belief that there is a strict intention to leave the pension aids separate and apart from other formula-driven aids, probably mostly for stability purpose And obviously, too, that's just directing the, for the pensions and not for other kinds of service provision.
And we'll be getting a more close-up look at the spreadsheets and so on. Perhaps today. We'll see. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dalton, your recent conversation here kind of leads in well with my thoughts here. Seems like you're trying to teach us college algebra. And I'm kind of looking for a solution that involves fifth grade math. maybe there's a happy median somewhere in a future formula. But the concept of need, I think, is interesting. It seems it's on every page here, and certainly I think that's one of the attempts we try to do, is to judge need. But I have a theory on that, and I want to get your thoughts on whether my thoughts are reasonably accurate or not. So you have need, and you look at a family, and maybe you have a family with dual income. And so if one of the two incomes goes away, there is a need to replace that income. So that's one judgment of need. So LGA would be that secondary income. But yet that doesn't at all understand whether that family is spending wisely or not, whether they're going out to eat every night, or whether their total income is just getting them by. And so that's another definition of need. So I'm wondering if, to what extent you feel LGA needs to support the need of a city. Is it the first definition or the second definition or somewhere in between?
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't think that's my judgment to make. You hold the elections certificate. There have been studies in the past, and I would definitely refer you to the CORE study that was done, that was paid for by the governor's office back in 1992, and I'm happy to give you a copy of it. Their goal, their stated goal, was indeed to identify minimum levels of service in various aspects of city service delivery that they were willing to support, as opposed to average level. I would say that the current formula is much more focused on providing average levels of service.
Okay, Representative Barrett, any follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dalton, the reason I asked you that question is you have 25 years experience, so understanding it's not your job, you know more about it than arguably most people at this table, certainly myself. I think our role would be to understand need as it relates to basic services that every city or county should provide. Has there been any study done regarding what is considered a basic service as opposed to a maybe a need rather than a want, and judging the level of aid against that basic level? Is there any information that could help us if we want to use that definition to help us with the decision-making process?
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative, I have not looked through the literature recently to see if there is, but I'm happy to take a look and see if there's anything that I could recommend as, you know, maybe a starting point for that discussion.
Sure. Thank you.
So here we are. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And first of all, you know, I know we're going to be looking at local government aid, and include me in on that LGA work group, if you would just put me down right now.
Perfect.
But, you know, I've heard a couple times where it's been stated that the original intent of local government aid was to deal with law enforcement, and I've heard that a couple times now. But if we're going to have an accurate and good discussion of local government aid, we can't start with false premises. And I think Ms. Dalton said this, and I've never known it to be, but LGA was not started to deal with law enforcement as a specific thing. So I think as we make statements around this table, we can't sit and assume these false premises. I mean, I think what's here in the report is it was to provide property tax relief and provide for basic services. And as mentioned, it would certainly be our intent if we develop a new formula to decide on all of these things. I mean, that's all a point of discussion. But I think what's important is that at least we start with correct premises on, you know, what the LGA formula was started and why it was started and so forth. I think before the recent changes, before 2001 and 2003 formula changes, I think only 17% of the funding in LGA was based on need. And now it's 95%. So a lot of the arguments that some of us have heard in the past were actually back in the 90s when, as Ms. Dalton said, you could distribute dollars and throw it out the back of an airplane and it would land about as good as the formula was indicating. But it is different. And the need factors now, whether or not you agree with them or not, was based on some sort of objective numbers. You know, just like that overburden, you know, there's been a lot of debate about the accident factor. But you know, if you live in Moorhead or, you know, some of these cities where you've got a lot of colleges or you've got more business and people coming in, you're going to have an overburden that just a regular formula. And of course, like any formula, like education, you can have a very simple formula, but it's probably not going to be a very fair formula. And unfortunately, to create more fairness and to get the unique abilities, you complicate things. And that's kind of the give and the take. And so I look forward to that work group. And I think local government aid is always something that should be looked at. But I do think what's important for any formula, whether or not it's local government aid or Green Acres or any program, is that it's based on something that is credible. Because I think that gives any program a long-term viability. And I know we're going to be talking probably about Green Acres. And, you know, there was problems with Green Acres. And so to continue, as a rural member, to continue a program that had some real problems, and as a rural member, where ultimately we may have lesser votes as time goes on and censuses progress, I wanted something that was very credible so that every member in the state, no matter where you're from, can look at a program and say, yes, that's trying to do what it's supposed to do. And so I think local government aid, the same thing. You know, it tends to go to rural Minnesota, 65%. So I want to make sure whatever formula we have is credible. So, and I think what we have right now, well, isn't perfect. At least people will say it's based on something objective and not just pulling things out of thin air. But some of my observations.
Well, Representative Marquardt, I mean, I appreciate your dispelling the myth, too. I mean, I think it's been circulating that right. It was set up for police and fire, and so I think part of our job as a committee is to, you know, have one common language about what it's all about. So I appreciate that. Yeah. Representative Wardlow?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dalton, members of the committee, I think, this is a very useful discussion we're having, but one thing that's clear to me reviewing this and learning a lot of these things for the first time is everything is very unclear. There is no clarity here. Representatives sitting at this table, I think, none of us have a complete picture of exactly what each part of this formula does or why. Clearly, we don't understand why it was originally put into place. We have disagreements about that. We have disagreements about why it currently exists. These are discussions we're going to have, and we need to start fresh, I think, and decide what this is supposed to do, if anything. That is clear to me. One of my favorite quotes from James Madison is that he said something to the effect of, paraphrasing, it's to no avail to choose your representatives if the laws are too long to be read or too confusing to be understood. And here we have a situation where the law is too confusing to be understood by legislators, let alone by average citizens. So what does that do? That makes it impossible for citizens to hold their elected officials, whether it be representatives or local government officials, accountable. And that allows for a bureaucratic fog or a fog of complication to surround decisions on what to spend money on at the local government level. And that leads to fiscal irresponsibility. And I think that the mandate of the people in this past election was to clear away that fog and to make things simple so that people can understand it and bring fiscal responsibility back to every level of government. Having said that, I think we can look back to 1971, and Ms. Dalton, maybe you can help me here. You had mentioned that there was a study about minimal service levels. And what year was that again?
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative, that was in, I believe, 1992.
That was 1992. Okay. Now, Madam Chair?
Representative
Wardle. Ms. Dalton, on slide 3 on page 2, it states that LGA in 1972, I believe, was designed to, 1972, was designed to replace a number of smaller tax sharing programs. Since it's really difficult to tell what the original intent of LGA was, is it easier to tell us what the intent of those smaller tax sharing programs that replaced were?
Ms. Dalton.
And what were they?
Madam Chair, Representative, I may actually defer to Joel Michael. He did give me a list of what were the local taxes. Cigarette, alcohol taxes, estate inheritance, and mortgage and deed taxes were all the smaller share taxes. And he may have a better idea of why they were share taxes. I would just make one comment, which is two-thirds of state taxes are raised at two-thirds of state and local taxes are raised at the state level. Two-thirds of state and local spending are made at the local level. So to that extent, there needs to be some shift somewhere in the system.
Madam Chair, Representative Wardlaw, I was just going to add that these shared taxes, the way this worked is they would be collected by the local government, and then part of the money would be forwarded to the state and the part retained locally. So that was kind of the state-local partnership up to that point consisted of a lot of these smaller taxes where there wasn't really any notion of how much need a community had. It was just a case of collecting these taxes and keeping some and sending some on to the state. Those were the shared taxes that we talk about a lot. And
yeah. Mr. Michael, anything to add?
I think what Stephen Pat said is a pretty good encapsulation. And, you know, there's some states where they still do that. Like in Ohio now, they're trying to repeal their estate tax so that they're much more like many of the other states. But they have the system that Minnesota had back in 71. And most of their estate tax is kept locally in the county at the city level, which makes it difficult for their state legislature to repeal it. Cutting local revenues. It was the same for our old inheritance tax was largely administered by the probate court and collected at that level. They just retained a fair chunk of that, and that was their local part of their local tax capacity. I'd have to go back and look. I think it may have been that some of the insurance premium tax was also kept locally.
Thank you. I mean, it sounds like some of these questions, we haven't had to go back to 72 and 71 for a while. But, I mean, knowing the origins is certainly important in terms of how this system has developed. Was there a follow-up, Representative Wardlow?
No, thank you very much.
Okay. And Representative Detmer?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And this goes back to Representative Loeffler's statement regarding fees. Is it allowable for, maybe some mayors could answer this, is it allowable for cities to put these fees, are they listed separately, or can they put in the general tax statement?
Representative Detmer, did you want to ask that of
whoever can answer that, I guess.
Ms. Schiff?
Madam Chair and Representative Detmer, I'm currently looking at the November 2010 forecast price of government, and they are listed as non-tax revenues, and there is I can make a copy of this available for everyone, but there are a number of different revenue categories, including selected enterprise revenues, charges for services, special assessments, licenses and permits, miscellaneous fees, and so we can get to a deeper level of individual non-tax revenues if you would like to see them. But this is the price of government is one of the tools that I was going to go over as we get to more fiscally related kinds of things, but we can make some information more available to you.
Representative Detmer?
Yes, Madam Chair, because I don't know if some of you have been getting calls regarding the street lights fees and also the stormwater sewer fees, and some of my constituents don't even have street lights. They don't have the stormwaters, but they still pay these fees. Would it benefit the taxpayer to have it in the tax statement versus a separate fee? Can the cities do that? That was my question.
Ms. Jill? Mr. Hines.
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, I'm not sure about the exact rules myself, but many times those fees can be included and, in fact, are included on the property tax statements, and that is, you know, one of the frustrations in some ways that it allows to be collected. It sort of shows up as part of property taxes in some ways, and yet it doesn't count for property taxes on the things Representative Loeffler mentioned, the PTR and the... in some cases, the income tax deductibility. Yeah, and one of the main reasons Ms. Dalton points out is that jurisdictions have gone to more of these fees is because that allows them to collect for these. Those are not covered by levy limits. So if a city or a county might be up against a levy limit, that might be a way to move some of that expense out of an area where it's covered by the levy by putting it on a fee, and yet they still can collect the fee through the property tax statement, if not technically a property tax. So there is kind of a slippery slope between those two or something. But I don't know the exact rules about which kinds of fees can go on a statement or not. But generally, I think the complaints you get are from ones that are on there, and those are fairly easy for a city to collect those.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative McDonald, was there a question?
Yeah, just to respond, Representative Dittmer, some of the cities can do intergovernmental loans from one account to another. For example, the city of Delano, if you have a municipal liquor store, we can certainly have that monies go in towards the general fund. So many of our fees and structures do go into the general fund as well. But I wanted to address the myth, or there was mentioned that there was a false presumption of what LGA was started on, and the myth, dispelling the myth. I think it's reasonable to assume that because LGA is for basic services, that cities' basic services include fire and protection. So I would say that it is not a false presumption or a myth that those basic services are fire and protection. That is what, as a taxperson, all of us ask our cities to do, is keep us safe. It is not for museums and water faucets and everything else that cities deem necessary for their cities. Not, I don't think the rest of the taxpayers, especially those of us who represent rural areas, believe that the metro area should be spending these LGA monies on exorbitant luxuries that are certainly not necessary and don't function under a basic services as the original intent. Madam Chairman, I forgot to address you. I'm very sorry. Thank you.
Representative McDonald, you're doing great. But Ms. Dalton, does the original statute, or does the current statute, just say anything about basic services versus any other type of services?
Madam Chair, Representative, the current law has no limitations on what local government aid can be spent for. It's a general purpose aid. It may be cities may spend it on anything that they have the authority to spend money on. To my knowledge, there has never been a limitation on that. I have not read the statute for every year between 71 and now, but certainly not in the last 25 years.
Representative mm-hmm. Lovchesky?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is such a great discussion, and I think it's just really helpful to see new faces think all these things through. And you know, I want to support Representative Marquardt in saying that simplicity is nice, but it really, really is very unfair. And so one simple thing to do would be to eliminate LGA, and the biggest winner in the room would be me. So because we don't receive any, and we're the biggest contributor to fiscal disparity, so we're supporting the rest of the state. So that's simple. So I think we all have to think that through, just in this room, just kind of, you know, and I don't know where everyone's from. It's so weird to talk to people I haven't even met yet. So but Representative Benson, Dietrich, myself, and Representative Wardlow, I think, are the members of this committee who are not recipients of these programs. So you certainly can see that these are bipartisan issues. They're not, you know, D's versus R's. They're kind of where you sit and kind of how you think about them. But I think one thing to think about, you know, on the law enforcement question, and, you know, I do think these programs should not be targeted for any sort of thing. And I'll tell you why. I think it's sort of a simple economics issue. If you have a kid who wants $10 for candy and you say, I'm not going to give you $10 for candy, and they come back and say, I'll have $10 for textbooks. You go, okay, $10 for textbooks. You free up that kid's resources to buy candy. So, I mean, I'm less interested in telling locally elected officials how to spend the money, because, you know what, they stand for election. Let them stand for election. Let them buy whatever they want. It's more how much you're going to give them. I think that's the key here. How much state subsidy are you going to give to local units of government? Now, if you did design a formula, and people have been saying in committees this year, you know, no legislature can bind a future legislature, and that's true. But all that really means is unless you have the courage and the guts to pass bills to change the rules, they've bound you. So if you don't change the formula, oh, absolutely. They have bound you. So this, you know, the formula we're under now is Governor Plenty's, and, you know, I said earlier I'm one of the supporters of it, but I see a lot of reason and encourage the new chair of property taxes to look at changing the formula. I think there's a lot going on that would be good information, but on law enforcement, I think just one way to think about that, probably per capita, I would guess that the highest law enforcement need per capita in the state would be in my city. We supply the police and bomb squad for the airport. We do it for the Mall of America. We have huge law enforcement per head. We have double the amount of people in my city who work in my city every day than reside in my city. So in that kind of formula approach, just for that, again, a city like mine would be probably the biggest winner in a formula, because we're providing so much police and fire for the rest of the state at the airport and at the Mall of America. And so, you know, I think all of these things, you know, you really have to kind of think through how they would all play out. And I just think it's exciting that people, you know, want to talk about it. I think we often hear in property taxes, and many of us are former mayors and council members and school board members and county commissioners and whatever. But we're also local control, but then, you know, we want to drill down and not give them any control either. So I think the bigger program is, you know, the bigger deal for legislators, just me personally, is what's the appropriation? What is the dollar amount the state of Minnesota is going to put into equalization? Because that's really what they are. And then, again, recalling that the biggest equalization program in the state is not happening at the state level. It's fiscal disparities with no state dollars at all. So I think it's kind of nice to hear people talk about it, and I think whoever is interested in learning about it, because it is hard to get it all, what I would say is the best way to understand all this stuff is to get on that LGA working group, and you will learn so much. And the way to learn something about something is to fix it. And so I think it's great that you're starting that off, Madam Chair, and I think this will be a good year for that discussion.
Thank you, Representative. We got about five people who want to ask a question, and I think there's a chance we can get through this still. So let's quickly get a question and see what we can do here. Representative Benson?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think maybe we had answered it, but you were going to respond to the discussion on that you were bringing up, Representative McDonald. But if that's okay, listening to the debate about whether LGA is too complicated or needs to be less complicated so that we have some accountability to the voters, or whether we're talking about candy or basic services and all those kinds of things, I noticed in the testimony that our presenter said that there are cities that depend up to 65% of their budgets for LGA. And I'm just curious, just as the example, you don't have to give me the name of the city or cities, but what would be the circumstances in which a city or a community had reached the point, what would be the characteristics of such a community that it had gotten to the point where it now had 65% of its budget based on LGA? And that might give us some indication of, you know, some of these other issues that have been floating around among us here this morning.
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative, without having the individual cities in front of me, and that, you know, 65% was based on some older data, I'm not sure that anyone is getting exactly that amount right now.
Right.
But I would say they tend to be very small. They tend to have virtually no tax base. They tend to have declining population. They tend to be in the rural areas. And they tend to be very old farming communities, primarily.
Okay. All right. Representative, is that good?
I just understand that there were some communities who had actually reached as much as 90%. So when we're talking about eliminating LGA, we're talking about severe impact on some communities. Now, my community, Representative Lanchesky's community, receives no LGA. So for me, representing my constituents, if the majority simply decided we're going to solve part of this budget problem by just eliminating LGA, I suspect we would soon see division among the two caucuses.
All right. Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as a new member to the committee, I made a commitment to kind of keep my mouth shut, although that's hard. In my district, I have venues where there are police officers that provide security. And for good or for bad, most of those police officers don't live in my district and probably wouldn't vote for me if they lived in my district. But I always ask, you know, what's the best thing that we can do up there at the Capitol to make your job easier? And they always talk about the kids. How do you keep kids from getting in trouble? And some of the comments were programs after school, parks, libraries. Oftentimes they talk about the cost, the ability of snow plowing so that their police cars can get through the streets. And I believe we had some problems just last month or so with fire engines getting through streets. So local government aid has very many different silos under police. I talked to a lot of business owners in my district and across the state. And they consistently talk about having workforce training programs so that they are not hiring people that they have to spend millions of dollars to train. And in the jobs committee, you'll hear oftentimes about how cities have to put the money forth for workforce training programs themselves. So someone else's idea of police and fire may be someone else's idea of I'm not sure how to phrase that, but we all have different views on what police and fire and local government aid cover. So it's a wide range. You have to be open to many new things to learn in this particular committee, I suspect.
Representative Mahoney, was there a question?
No, there's no question.
All right, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I think this is a great discussion because I think this really is at the heart of our work, and I hope that we'll have as much discussion when we get to the next topic on county aid. So if that goes to the next meeting, I hope you'll forgive us. But I do think that we need to, and, you know, I wasn't paying attention in 71 in the way that, you know, people who were at the table did, but I have to say I think we all need to think through at least what I've read about that period of time. It was really not inspired about anything related to our local governments. It was really about the taxpayers and were they getting a fair chance at an equal opportunity of quality of life based on what the tax burden that they were paying. And Governor Wendy Anderson ran on the platform. I think he's the last governor we had to actually run on a policy platform. His position was that the quality of a child's education shouldn't be dependent on the property tax wealth of the community that they lived in. And he ran around the state and pointed out communities that were paying twice as high a rate in taxes. And it wouldn't raise anything because they had no tax base as a wealthy community that had an absolutely outstanding education system with more resources and smaller class sizes. And they said that's not fair. And in the local government sector, it was the same sort of thing. It was like, hey, you know, why should somebody be paying so much more property taxes than someone else? And are we asking local governments to do the right thing? And it's more efficient to collect cigarette taxes at the state level than to have every little city clerk collecting it up and dividing it up and sending it back. And so it was similar to the times that we have now in terms of trying to figure out which level of government does things the best. And should taxes in general be raised on a bigger base so that places that just because of geography, time, or special burdens have unique needs that just aren't like the rest of the state. And I think those are some of the things we're going to have to wrestle with as we move forward, because I do think it really started from the taxpayer rather than which local government has the best budgeting system. It wasn't really focused on that. And I think we need to think about those basics as well.
Okay, Representative Barrett.
Madam Chair, I'll pass in the interest of time.
All right. It looks like we're not going to be able to finish with county property aids. So we get to have you back sometime. But I know that just a couple of minutes from Michelle, I think you had something you wanted to...
Right. Madam Chair and members, in your packet, you have a catalog of budget activities. And as we've had today's meeting, I recognized members having questions that could have been answered by the quick reference provided by this package. For example, Representative McDonald, taconite aids are described on page 21, pension aids on page 22. Representative Lincheski, fiscal disparities on page 25. As I move on down, there are others in here. LGA is on page 12. The idea of the reference is to give you not only a spending reference, catalog of budget activities. Looks like this. If you didn't get one, let me know. I'll make sure you get one. But it provides basic background information and spending information from 2008 to including the November forecast through 15. Hopefully this might give you more of a base for some of the questions that you have.
Sounds like the buzzer's ringing. So I think we're going to adjourn the committee. Thanks, members. Thanks.